It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll continue our candidate forums with Jason Liebeck, Libertarian candidate for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District.
First, youth prisons in Wisconsin, such as Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, have been at the center of a firestorm as stories have been made public about poor facilities, allegations of abuse and neglect, and chronic understaffing.
The state is currently planning to increase funding for the youth prison system to address some of these issues, but a Milwaukee-based advocacy group says that it's time to close these facilities and find alternative ways to rehabilitate children in the justice system.
Joining us to talk about this is Charlene Moore. She's the director of the Urban Underground and a coalition member of Youth Justice Milwaukee. Charlene, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So what does your group, your coalition, why does it want to close youth prisons in Wisconsin?
So, number one, youth prisons, as far as the data shows, it shows that it doesn't work. These large institutionalized systems that have been set up to, quote-unquote, rehabilitate our young people, the recidivism rate of young people going back into the system is at an astounding rate. And so we knew that we had to reach out to partners throughout the city, throughout the nation, to talk about and to look at, okay, what's working, what's not working. And we know that what's going on and, you know, all the stories that came out about Lincoln Hills, we know that systems like that do not work. So we need to invest in better alternatives.
And what are these alternatives that Youth Justice Milwaukee is putting forward?
Sure, sure. So I would love to just briefly talk about 4 recommendations that Youth Justice Milwaukee is putting out. Our first recommendation is to increase public safety by creating a continuum of community-based non-residential services that will reduce risk and reduce racial and ethnic disparities within the juvenile system. And by continuum, we mean invest in community-based organizations and treatment programs focused on rehabilitating youth in their communities instead of incarcerating them. Additionally, the continuum would include funding for prevention-based interventions to reduce risk factors and strengthen protective factors. The second recommendation is to end placement of adjudicated youth at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. We want, you know, judges, we want, you know, folks to stop sending our young people up to a system that isn't working for them. We feel it best to identify and contract with small residential programs in Milwaukee with experience working with high-risk youth. Milwaukee youth housed at Lincoln Hills should be brought back home and safely treated in programs designed to work with youth and with high-risk needs. Our third recommendation is to increase meaningful engagement with families of youth in the system. We recognize that families have special knowledge that can enhance the design of interventions and treatment. Parents are typically have more contact with their children than any system professional, and they can share cultural knowledge that is critical to contextualizing interventions to make it more effective. And our last recommendation at this point is includes community stakeholders in a data-driven approach, collaborative planning process to make juvenile justice services more transparent, accountable, and effective. And what that means is that we partner with members of impacted communities to create a continuum of services and supports that is responsive to the needs of young people, their families, and their communities. And our full report is also located on our organization's website, www.urbanunderground.org, spelled just like it sounds, under the publication tab. You can pull the same report, and I'm reviewing the same information from there.
Yeah, and Charlene, going back to, I believe it was your third point, about really reaching out to families of youth who are incarcerated, getting ideas from them who have firsthand knowledge of what it's like to have a child behind bars. have you talked to these families in putting together your report? What are they telling you about how they want to reform the system?
Yeah, so the beautiful thing about our coalition is that it includes family members. We actually have a mother that has her child currently up at Lincoln Hills. And these recommendations were created by, once again, those mostly impacted by the system. We've had focus group with young people. We've had focus group with parents. And so we're taking these recommendations specifically from what the need of our community, what they're saying. This is what they're saying. And so we have included those specifically being impacted by the system to put forth these recommendations.
And you have said that you don't want to see these youth shipped out to these residential facilities out of Milwaukee County. You want to bring the youth back in closer to rehabilitate, closer to home. Can you give us a sense of how many children and teens from Milwaukee end up in these facilities compared to the rest of the state?
Sure. So Milwaukee has the most number of young people currently at Lincoln Hills. So currently right now, just to give you an estimate, we have about 100 young people currently, probably give or take, but it's probably about 100 young people that are housed from Milwaukee out at Lincoln Hills. Now, other counties have, probably their numbers are single digit or double, very low double digit numbers, but we are by far the greatest county, or the county that sends the greatest number of young people to Lincoln Hills.
We're talking with Charlene Moore. She's the director of the Urban Underground and coalition member of Youth Justice Milwaukee. Charlene, one of the ideas coming from the state is to pour more money into the juvenile justice system. Would that help rehabilitate the prisons themselves?
We wish that was the case, but unfortunately, pouring more money into a system that is failing is not the correct solution. Again, we're a very data-driven coalition, so we're looking at data of recidivism rates, not just in Wisconsin, but across the country. And there was also a new report put out by the Harvard Kennedy School of Criminal Justice Policy and Management, that their report, it's entitled New Thinking in Community Corrections. Other folks have put out reports to say, you know what, these large institutions that are punitive, they're not restorative, they're not rehabilitative, they're large environments. We have young people that have committed low offense crimes, with young people that have committed more serious offenses intermingled together. Once you start mixing these young people, you can just imagine, what they're being taught, and then they come back out and then go right back in. So we know, once again, based on data, that this system that currently has existed for so long is no longer working. And we need to look at some new approaches that have been working.
As you look out across the country at these new approaches, are there programs you would like to see as a model for what could happen perhaps in Milwaukee County?
Yeah, there's a few. Again, I think that Milwaukee has to create, look at what others are doing and kind of piece it together to look at what's going to work for Milwaukee or for Wisconsin as a whole. And so we have looked at, there's a model called ARC, A-R-C, that has smaller, they have smaller house, they're homes, they're really homes. Some are secured, some are unsecured, depending on the young person that needs to be at that particular home. There's one that is restorative, as well as meets the health needs of some of our young people that are dealing with some really critical, mental health issues, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that particular model we really like because it was small. There's upwards of about no more than 15 young people that are placed in these environments where they're getting the necessary one-on-one care that they need. And once again, it's a restorative justice model, because who have never made – I want to find one adult that never made a mistake as an adolescent. You know, I would love to find that person, right, that never made a mistake. Young people make mistakes. Their brains aren't fully developed until they're about, you know, age 24, 25, right? And so it's important that we're looking at how do we protect our young people? How do we provide them the necessary? If you make a mistake, okay, we're going to nurture you. We're going to provide you with the right tools and equip you so that you can be productive. At the end of the day, we want them to be productive young adults.
Well, thank you so much for taking time with us, Charlene.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Charlene Moore is the director of the Urban Underground and a coalition member of Youth Justice Milwaukee. She joined us to talk about Youth Justice Milwaukee's call to close youth prisons, such as Lincoln Hills, in order to find a more equitable justice system for Wisconsin's youth.
We continue our series of candidate interviews for Wisconsin's 2016 congressional races. We've invited candidates running to represent Wisconsin to join us on Central Time and the Joy Cardine Show.
Today, we go to Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which includes Kenosha, Racine, and other cities in the southeast corner of the state. Jason Liebeck is the Libertarian candidate in the race. He's running against Republican incumbent and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan from Janesville, Democratic candidate Ryan Solon, and Trump conservative candidate Spencer Zimmerman.
Jason Liebeck is in the studio now with us to talk about his candidacy. Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
Start with a basic question. Why are you running for Congress?
I'm running because I believe people are tired of career politicians that are paying attention to their big money donors and special interest groups more than they pay attention to the constituents within their districts. When looking at the field for this race, I didn't see anybody that I wanted to support, and so I decided to run.
You mentioned not seeing anyone that you wanted to support, so you ran in that sense. So what sets you apart from the other candidates in this race?
Well, I'm a libertarian, and what I want to do is I want to minimize government's involvement in our lives. I believe that the federal government has a role to protect our citizens from foreign threats and to have a legal system. But other than that, I want to minimize government, which means more tax money in your pockets and let you live your life how you see fit, as long as you're not harming others.
Let's look at how that might play out in your policy. What are some of the most important issues facing your district?
Okay. Well, I think around the world, or around the country, and especially in southeast Wisconsin, it's jobs, right? And so what I want to do is I want to minimize regulations that would prohibit growth of the private sector. I would like to allow our innovators and our job creators to be able to grow and expand their businesses.
And what sorts of policies do you think would favor that?
Well, I believe that there's the minimum wage issue that is very popular to talk about. I personally don't support a minimum wage because what happens is if you raise the minimum wage beyond the value that an employer would get from someone's efforts, then I don't think those people will be employed.
So you don't support raising the minimum wage, or you don't support any minimum wage?
I believe that the minimum wage is really zero. You know, if the employers don't get enough value out of people, then they're not going to hire them. You know, when I was a kid, I worked at Dairy Queen, and I got valuable job experience because my boss was able to pay me what I was worth, you know, not, you know, some artificially high value.
Now, you're in a race with several other people for the 1st Congressional District seat there. And how do you think Paul Ryan, as a Speaker of the House, has handled his years in office?
Well, I believe that he talks a pretty good game about being conservative in the economic sense and a smaller government and whatnot. But I believe that he's beholden to his big money donors, and he will grow power for himself and his party and look out for his special interest groups.
So you've mentioned a couple times now wanting to have a separation, it sounds like, between donors and politicians, career politicians. Mm-hmm. You're against that. So what sorts of things would you do to bring about the kind of politician you're hoping for that would have that, would not be a career politician?
Right. Well, we can definitely do term limits. If we implement term limits, then what we have is, an opportunity for more people to come through, and the big money donors aren't buying these people because they're not going to have them for 20, 30, 40 years in some cases. What I would like to do, with minimizing the role of the federal government in the vast majority of things is, by giving away power, not having that power at the federal level, then the big money donors and special interests, they're not going to buy our politicians because the politicians have less power to give favors in the forms of bailouts, friendly regulations, and subsidies.
We're talking with Jason Liebeck right now. He's joining us in studio. He's a Libertarian candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 1st District, joining us as part of our candidate forums here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And Jason, I want to ask you about the criminal justice system and any sorts of reform that you might be looking at. What is your platform there?
Okay. The criminal justice reform, I believe what we need to do is we need to stop incarcerating people for victimless crimes. And so part of the libertarian platform includes, allowing you to make choices with your body as long as you're not harming other people. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to agree with all your choices. So, for example, drugs. Marijuana is a big thing. We see efforts to legalize it across the country. What's happening is we have a choice that people are smoking marijuana, and then we're spending all this money and time and effort to put them in jail when there's no victim to this crime. You can make the case that they're harming their bodies, but as long as you're not harming others, then why are we incarcerating these people? What we see too is the prosecution of this crime, specifically marijuana, for example, it affects some communities more than others. So despite drug use being pretty consistent across the races, African American community is being incarcerated many times more than the white community, and the Latino community is also incarcerated more than the white community. So,
looking big picture now, one possible election outcome, Republicans could keep the majority in the House while Democrats could control the Senate and or the White House. What would you do if you were elected to help create bipartisan legislation that both sides could agree upon, including a libertarian like yourself?
Right. I don't believe that either side has a monopoly on good ideas. And frankly, I think most of the time when you're trying to grow government and grow power for your party, I'd say that both parties have a lot of bad ideas. But I am willing to work with anybody that wants to minimize government's intrusion into your life and will be constitutional about the things that they do. So
with those goals in mind, if you were to be elected, what would be your top priority of the beginning of your term?
Okay. Well, I think one thing that would be a good place to start would be a bill that is one topic per bill. And so what that would entail is, bills that are put before our legislators, it needs to be one topic. It can't have, you know, these poison pills that cause so much animosity, you know, where our, you know, the left and the right, they're, you know, kind of trying to trade favors or trying to kill these bills based off of what they put into it. So if you have one topic in a bill, then it's just a vote on that topic, and that would make our politicians more accountable for the votes that they have. And when you have politicians that are accountable to their constituents, then I think things would work much better.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time.
That was Jason Liebeck, Libertarian candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 1st District. He's running against Republican incumbent and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan from Janesville, who we've reached out to for an interview. We've also spoken to Democratic candidate Ryan Solon, who was on the show yesterday. And later on, we'll be talking with Trump conservative candidate Spencer Zimmerman. You can find more information about our candidate forums and all of our election and political coverage at WPR.org. It's Halloween weekend, and this Food Friday, we get ready for the spookiest night of the year with Halloween-themed food. Today, we'll get fun ideas for sweet or savory foods that you can serve at your dinner table or at a Halloween party.
Anna Monette Roberts joins us now to tell us more. She's the food editor of Pop Sugar, where she develops and photographs recipes. She's a graduate of the chef's training program at the Natural Gourmet Institute and has worked in restaurants, bakeries, and even had a stint as a chocolatier. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Well, I always think of Halloween as the food, all those trick-or-treaters, their loot that comes home. But there's so much more to talk about in terms of Halloween-inspired recipes. What ways can we expand our idea of Halloween food?
Well, I think it's important to begin every party with something delicious to drink. And I recommend a butter beer that's inspired by Harry Potter. I developed this recipe because I've always dreamed of an actual butter beer made with butter and beer. And that's kind of how I think J.K. Rowling intended or invented this creation to be. And so basically, you can throw the ingredients into a slow cooker. It's just two ingredients, a butterscotch sauce and a pumpkin beer. And it just, the flavors meld together to create a really frothy and comforting, rich and thick beverage. And it's the perfect amount of sweet and caramelized flavor.
And that's served hot if it's in a slow cooker. Yeah. And how do you top it off? Do you top it off with anything?
I personally don't, because it creates a natural foam. But I guess, you know, there are other options. You could do whipped cream if you wanted to make it more decadent. But really, it already has that froth on top.
So does it taste like a dessert?
I would say it's a sweeter beverage, of course, but it's not too intense. I would say it's a really great way to kick a party off. Of course, if you're serving something for the little ones at the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, they do butter scotch soda. So you could always do that with whipped cream for the little ones to make them feel like they're part of the party.
Well, let's dive into some of the recipes which are posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's start with the curry pumpkin soup. What's the story behind that?
Well, I went to culinary school, and one thing that we learned was you always want to cook with fresh pumpkin in savory applications and canned pureed pumpkin in sweet applications. And the reason for that is texture. You'll notice with a pureed pumpkin in a can, it has a gummy, super smooth texture, which is great when you're making muffins or cake. But when it comes to soup, you really don't want that gumminess. You need a little fiber. So I developed this recipe to basically explain the easy process of roasting whole pumpkin and then making use of the seeds and roasting those as well as a topper to the soup.
So is it a lot of work to roast a whole pumpkin? I love pumpkin, and but I always use, you know, the cans of pumpkin. I've never roasted my own pumpkin. How much goes into that?
It's really, well, it starts with a sharp knife and safely cutting the pumpkin in half. And then you just kind of butter it up or, you know, I guess put some oil on the top of it and roast it in a 350-degree oven until it's fork tender, which usually takes less than an hour because most people will be working with a pretty small size sugar pumpkin that they'll find at their grocery stores.
And people are often used to using pumpkin in pie, of course, and in sweet cooking. What are some things to keep in mind if you're just starting to use pumpkin in your sweet recipes?
Well, I recommend two recipes. The easiest recipe is a pumpkin pie truffle that I helped develop. And the method behind that is using ingredients you'll traditionally see in a pumpkin pie. So graham cracker, pumpkin puree, pumpkin spice, and cream cheese. And you blend those things together in a food processor and then form those into truffle-sized balls, and you can dip them into melted chocolate. So that's really easy, and you get all of that flavor that you would traditionally find without having to bake or really fuss over anything.
And it's a finger food.
It's a finger food, which is so perfect when you're serving that on a platter at a party.
It's and food. Then, go ahead.
Oh, and then, you know, if you're more ambitious and you'd like to try a cake, I also have developed a recipe for, I call it a naked cake. This is something you'll see on Pinterest a lot. And that's an icing technique where it really doesn't require any skill. You just smooth the frosting over the top of a cake. And I developed this recipe for beginner bakers who, you know, are fearful that their layer cake won't turn out or will be too crumbly. This one is just really a straightforward recipe.
And this is called a naked cake. I guess you're saying because it can be daunting to frost the sides of the cake, right?
Yes, so much can go wrong. Usually what happens is the cake crumbs kind of come up into the frosting, and it kind of ruins the presentation and also the texture of the frosting. So this way it's just, it's a beautiful rustic presentation, but without any of the fear of, you know, messing it up.
We're talking with Anna Monette Roberts, who is food editor at Pop Sugar, where she develops and photographs recipes. Anna, it seems with all of these recipes that your crock pot is never far from you in these recipes. How important is having a crock pot?
Oh, huge, especially for our readers. And I think really for anyone, because we're all so busy. And what it's kind of funny, what made me start recipe developing for a crock pot is I'd come up and I'd go to the first floor of my apartment and, you know, someone would be cooking tacos and I could smell all those aromas. And then on the second floor, they'd be having steak and the third floor would be pizza. And I'd come home to my empty studio and be really depressed. And so this was a way to kind of combat that. I can throw all the ingredients in the morning and then come home to an aromatic warm apartment with something bubbling and ready to go, which is what we all really want and crave after a long, busy day. So I recently developed I'm calling it a French onion pot pie soup in my crock pot.
Sounds like a lot of tasty stuff going into that one. What is it?
Yes. So this is actually, I guess, based on a couple of things. We're seeing a lot of people love comfort foods combined together. And so I made a French onion soup in the crock pot, but I also included a chuck roast, which of course is a chuck steak is very a very affordable cut of meat. And when it slow cooks, it's sort of the fat sort of melts. And if you give it enough time, usually 8 to 9 hours, that meat just falls like off. It just shreds. And so it just creates a really rich and comforting soup to come home, or stew, really. And I served it with some Gruyere pie crust crackers, because traditionally in French onion soup, you melt the cheese on top, but I really like dipping dipping crackers into my soup.
We're talking to Anna Munnett Roberts, recipe developer and food editor at Pop Sugar, and we're getting Halloween-inspired recipe ideas that include sweet and savory cooking.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. What do you like to cook in fall and around Halloween time? Do you put your own spin on fall classics, maybe some of these pumpkin recipes that we've been talking about today? You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up the conversation with Anna Munnett Roberts. She's a recipe developer and food editor at Pop Sugar. She's telling us how you can make Halloween-inspired meals.
And we'd love to hear from you. Are there certain sweet or savory meals that you like to make for Halloween or maybe just late fall yummy stuff that's comforting? Tell us how you might work classic foods like that pumpkin we're talking about into your sweet cookie, or maybe you've got a savory way to cook pumpkin. Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And if you've got a question that Anna can answer about how to make your cooking a little more fun for Halloween, Anna is here for you. Our number 800-642-1234.
And Anna, if you wouldn't mind, take us back to the pumpkins and take us through a meal from start to finish and see, you know, could we weave pumpkins perhaps into every part of that meal or in any hidden part?
You mean for your Halloween party?
Yeah, for our
so
Halloween.
So beginning with the drink?
Uh-huh, yep.
Yes, well, of course, you know, the butter beer recipe I have has pumpkin ale, but another drink I love to make is a bourbon beverage, and you add just a little bit of, I have a pumpkin simple syrup recipe on Pop Sugar, and you just add a little bit of that and top it with ginger beer, and that's just such an easy and elegant presentation for pumpkin. And for an appetizer, I would say to make crostini. So you can take a baguette or, you know, a cracker and spread some goat cheese on that and top it with a little bit of roasted pumpkin. I go through the explanation of how to roast a fresh pumpkin in that soup recipe I shared. But just top it with that and maybe a little bit of chopped sage and freshly ground pepper.
Mm-hmm.
And then for a main, I would definitely recommend doing a soup or I have a recipe that I really love. Actually, it's not mine. It's a Thug Kitchen recipe for a lasagna that incorporates pumpkin puree. So I think what you could even do like a traditional Italian lasagna, but you could fold in some pumpkin puree into the tomato sauce. That's an easy way and easy, you know, to make ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then dessert, of course, I mean, you name it, you can do cakes, cookies. I have a chocolate chip cookie that I also love that has pumpkin puree. And one thing to note with any time you are cooking with or baking with pumpkin puree, the result will end up a bit cakey. So when it comes to cookies, that's worth noting because they do end up a little bit cakier rather than chewy or super or crunchy.
We've been focusing a lot on pumpkin, which is delicious. At farmers markets in Wisconsin, I know right now what's there is a lot of winter squash. You've got your acorn squash and your butternut squash. Do you think you could sub in some different kinds of squash for the pumpkin?
Oh, absolutely. And I'd say one of my favorite squashes, which is beginning to gain a lot of popularity, is spaghetti squash. And that's so fun, especially if you have kids. That is the most fun project to get kids involved in. Because once you roast the spaghetti squash, you use a fork to kind of pull up the strands and they appear just like spaghetti. And you can add a meat sauce to that, or you can just dress it simply with olive oil and Parmesan cheese. The sky is really the limit, but that's just a really fun and kind of spooky and creative way to get to make use of all those wonderful gourds available to you.
The spaghetti squash really intrigues me. I want to try it, but I haven't yet because I guess I'm afraid that it's not going to taste very good, that it's going to taste like stringy undercooked squash. Is it good? Can you sell me on that?
I love it. Of course, it's not the exact texture of a wheat spaghetti, but it is, you know, when it's cooked thoroughly and when it's seasoned with enough salt, I'm a big fan of adding, you know, plenty of oil and salt when you're roasting it. That way the salt can kind of get in between those strands. It really does have a great kind of crunchy, not crunchy, but like it has a tooth to it. So when you chew it, like there's some texture, and I think it's one of the most delicious gourds out there for sure.
We're talking with Anna Munnett Roberts, who is a food editor at Pop Sugar, where she develops and photographs recipes. Anna, I picked up pumpkin bread this morning at the grocery store, trying to get in the mood for this segment. I probably should have baked pumpkin bread myself. I imagine, it's not too complicated. Ari, do you have some suggestion for seasoning in pumpkin bread and muffins? Any tips?
Oh, definitely. I learned this from my grandmother. My grandmother is in her late 80s, and I just went and visited her in Mississippi. And she always gets so many of those quick breads during the holiday season. And so I would recommend slicing them, whatever you're eating that day, and putting some salted butter on top and toasting it in a very high oven, like 425 degrees, until that butter melts and the edges crisp up and become caramelized. That's my absolute favorite way to simply dress up really anything, pumpkin bread or pumpkin muffins. I'm going to stick with that one because that's really, you can't beat that.
Melt in your mouth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's take a caller now. We've got Russ joining us in Monroe. Russ, hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Good. Show.
In the fall, man, we love to grill and smoke meats, especially we do ribs. And we came up with this sauce or glaze that's got pumpkin and molasses and bourbon, cinnamon. It's got a little clove, but it's got that fall kind of feel. And we smoke it usually with a little hickory, but that seems like fall and Halloween to me to be tearing meat off the bone. But I'd be interested if she had any other barbecue-related or sauces that seem this to this time of year.
No, that's a fun question, Russ, and that sounds really yummy. Bourbon pumpkin barbecue. So what about that, Anna? Does that ring any bells?
What I think of, I love brining meat and beer, especially chicken. So what comes to mind is taking the time, at least 4 hours, to brine a chicken in a bag. You can do pumpkin ale with it, and you can add a pinch of some seasoning, what's traditionally found in a pumpkin pie, so those warming spices. I'm all about simplicity, so that's probably the one thing that comes to mind for.
All right, Russ, thanks for that.
And kids are the life of the party at Halloween. You know, they love Halloween. Are there kid-friendly, spooky recipes that you could recommend that would get the kids involved in the cooking?
I honestly don't remember eating pumpkin as a kid, unless it was in a pumpkin bread or a treat. I really recommend those pumpkin pie truffles for kids because the kid, of course, can press the button on that food processor and feel like they're being part of the baking process. And then they can use their hands to roll those truffles up into balls. So I think that's really the most kid-friendly recipe that I've developed.
So we have not carved our pumpkins yet. We're kind of behind this year. And one of the things I totally look forward to is the pumpkin seeds. But we always just toss them in olive oil or whatever oil, salt them, bake them. And they're really fibrous. Usually I'm the only one who eats them, but I think they're really good. Do you have any other suggestions for using those pumpkin seeds?
Yes. In fact, you're right. They are fibrous. And I think that is important to note that there's two types of pumpkin seeds, those that you find directly out of your pumpkin and also store-bought pepitas, which you can usually find in the bulk section of your grocery store. And I actually think those are way more tastier, the pepitas, because they're hulled, meaning that fibrous exterior is removed. But they're my three favorite ways to season pumpkin seeds. One would be just traditional salt and either butter or an oil like olive oil. And then one thing I learned, I think it was from my mom's friend. She loves soy sauce, and you can actually roast the pepitas or pumpkin. Well, I would actually recommend the pepitas. Roast them over the stovetop until they toast. And then at the last minute, you can add in your soy sauce or tamari, and it has the best, most savory flavor. Hmm. That's my absolute favorite way to make pumpkin seeds. And then the last way is a sweet application. And you basically melt butter and toss those pumpkin seeds in butter and a little bit of demerara. I always mispronounce it, but the demerara or raw sugar, as well as that pumpkin pie spice. So and then bake or roast those until they're golden brown. And the one important thing to note is once those seeds are fragrant and you can really smell them out of the oven, remove them and then transfer them into a separate bowl, because there's something called carryover cooking, and you don't want to burn those seeds. I know everyone has done it once in their life, and mm-hmm. it smells terrible and the flavor is awful. So remember to transfer those seeds after you've roasted them.
And if you need a shortcut to squash and pumpkins, how does the microwave factor in? How do these do in the microwave? Or do you really need to do the baking?
We do have a recipe for microwaving squash. So what you want to do is start by cutting the squash in half, and in a microwave-proof dish, you like a Pyrex, put that squash face down and add a little bit of water and microwave it. I couldn't tell you how many minutes. Every microwave is different, but check on it in intervals. And you want that squash to be fork tender. And if you notice the water has evaporated off of the bottom of the pan, you want to make sure to fill up a little more water, at least an inch. And I think that's probably the simplest way to microwave a squash.
Well, lots of yummy ideas. Anna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Anna Manette Roberts. She's the food editor of Pop Sugar, where she develops and she photographs recipes. And you can find a lot of those recipes that we talked about today, the naked pumpkin cake, the stoops in the crock pot. Stoops? Did I say stoops? Stew and soup. I think that works. That's on the Central Time Facebook page. You can find those there. We talked about making Halloween-inspired foods. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, I bet listeners have Halloween costumes all set and prepared, but I've been scrolling through social media looking at the hashtag Hamilween. It's costumes that embrace the hit Broadway musical Hamilton.
So what we're hearing and seeing is that some people are dressing up as Alexander Hamilton this year. This is a big trend, and they're even dressing up as the creator of Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda. It's probably kind of synonymous in people's heads by this point. People are even painting on goatees.
Yes, and there was also an Allie Hamilton who channeled that 1700s clothing in a bit more feminine way. I'm wondering...
You're not saying sexy Hamilton, are you?
I wanted to refrain from that word, but you know, you get the picture.
Oh, no. There you go. Of course, it had to be. Well, I will not be dressing... I like the ideas, though. I like... Yeah. If I were to dress up, I think I would go as Lafayette, because he's so awesome in that musical.
Yeah, and, you know, I would just try my hand at Hamilton himself. I've seen... There are a lot of pictures, and it looks like a pretty accessible costume. You know, you could pull it off.
Could pull this off, right? Yeah. I like it. Well, if you're dressing up as a character from Hamilton, send us your pictures on the Central Time Facebook page. And in the meantime, happy Hamilween on Central Time.